I think we dug up Eric Zorn now. You there, Mr. Z?
I am. I'm technology. You know, I don't know what's going on. I had everything all hooked up, and then you disappeared. So, but I'm here, and thanks for that introduction. And I always appreciate just about every time on your show, I get a couple of emails from your listeners who want to sign up for the Picayune Sentinel, and I really appreciate that. You asked what we had in common over the weekend. I didn't hear the answer, but I'm wondering, what did you go to a wedding of some importance?
I did. I wasn't a speaker, though. How did it go for you and your son and daughter-in-law?
It was really nice. They had decided to do a destination wedding of sorts at Williams Orchard out near LaPorte, Indiana. Really lovely setting and a very ambitious wedding. And it came off just about without a hitch. There was just absolutely no problems. And, you know, everybody's always worried about, you know, when it comes to weddings, about every little thing not going right. And everything I can think of went exactly according to plan, which is unheard of at a wedding.
But it's so true. I had the same thought. I was just, I just went to the wedding. I had nothing to do with it. But a few years ago, my son got married, and the amount of detail. And I just thought, we aren't equipped to. We're not, you know, and we even had a helper, like a planner help with the wedding, or they did. And I guess we all did. But, you know, ordinary families aren't entertainment production companies, and yet we all get thrust into this show that we put on, and then every detail gets scrutinized and noticed, and you hope it goes well. You described your son's wedding as ambitious. What was the most ambitious part about it, Eric?
Let's see. Well, first of all, just the location was ambitious. We had people coming in from all over the country. You know, landing at O'Hare, it's about a 2-hour drive down there to Northwest Indiana. So, you know, getting everybody there, finding Airbnbs for people who were going to stay overnight, getting all the coordination with the caterers and the venue. We ended up with like 3 or 4 cars just packed to the gills of stuff that they wanted for their, you know, for their centerpieces, and their, you know, they had a whole game table, and they were making a quilt that they wanted people to do quilt squares for, and then wow. we had a string band jam session. You know, Ben's an old time fiddler, so we had his friends joining him down there, and they had a big circle and playing fiddle tunes for a while during cocktail hour, which was really, really fun. And they read this really wonderful Neil Gaiman poem at the ceremony itself, which I don't know if you know this poem, but it talks about what wedding is, what a marriage is, and it says, it's not two broken halves becoming one. It's the light from a distant lighthouse bringing you both safely home, because home is wherever you are, both together. And in the darkness, you will reach out a hand, not knowing for certain someone else is even there. And your hands will meet, and then neither of you will ever need to be alone again. It's a beautiful poem and a beautiful ceremony. So,
well, I got goosebumps. I got goosebumps there, my friend. And I've been crying a lot lately, too, for some of the simplest reasons. That's positively lovely. Was the idea, Eric, that people would bring a square, and then in real time, somebody would stitch them together into a quilt at the ceremony?
No, the idea was that you would draw a square. They had art supplies there, and they would give you a square to draw on, and you would draw, and then my new daughter-in-law's aunt is going to put them all together into a quilt.
Wow.
It was just a really nice thing. We had, you know, the typical toast. I had to deliver a toast. Which was a little bit of extra pressure. It went well. I kept it short and sweet, and Johanna, my wife, edited it down for me. She got rid of some of the jokes. She said, don't go there, you know. But it was really great. And Corey is our new daughter-in-law's name, and she's taken Ben's last name, our last name, so she's moved from the beginning of the alphabet to the end, and her name is now Corey Zorn. Which someone pointed out sounds a lot like corazón, which is Spanish for heart. And it shows up in all kinds of, you know, anytime you listen to Spanish language radio, they're always singing about corazón. So we love her, and we're really happy about it. And that's one kid married and two to go. We were putting a little bit of pressure on the other two, who are both in long-term relationships, saying, well, hey, come on now, let's keep this wedding thing going here. So.
Well, I'm happy for you and them, and it sounded really thoughtful and well done. And I'll second what Johanna said, not having seen or heard any of your speech, and I know you're a man of words and sometimes few words, but nobody ever left a wedding or a funeral and said, boy, I wish they talked longer. That never happens. So let that be a message to everybody who's asked to MC, give a toast, or speak at an event. Nobody ever walked away going, boy, I could have used five more minutes of that. That never happens. Never happens.
I have a piece of advice for potential bride and grooms, for prospective bride and grooms, I should say. And that is, you should not stress too much about the exact number of guests at your wedding. That the number will, you'll pick a number you want, and you'll hold firm to that, and you'll say, we can't invite them because we got too many people. But on the day of the wedding, people always have to flake out for one reason or another. We had a couple of people get sick, or somebody else had a really big conflict, another person had a professional obligation that came up. So they ended up about four or five people short, and there were four or five people that they could have invited. It's just like, I think you need to be relaxed about the exact number of guests that you have. That there's going to always be room for a couple of extra people, and you shouldn't stress too much about keeping it to an exact number. That's Uncle Eric's advice to brides and grooms.
Eric Zorn's the publisher of the Picayune Sentinel. If you email ericzorn@gmail.com, he'll sign you up. Pay a little bit, you get the premium edition, which I recommend. Let's talk about some of the things that we'll talk about, among other places, on the Mincing Rascals podcast tomorrow. Just what's your 30,000-foot observation about the debate tonight?
I'm interested in a couple of things are catching my eye. One is that they're not allowing opening statements, which I think is a really good idea. I think that's a terrific notion. The other is that there is not going to be a live studio audience. And I think that's a good idea. That was the case in the previous presidential debate, the disaster for Joe Biden. That you don't want your candidate speaking to an audience. You don't want the audience interrupting. You want there to be a clear presentation. I don't like the fact that they're not allowed to have notes.
Yeah,
on their podium. I feel like, you know, it's like in real life, you're going to be able to consult notes, and why not have them there?
This isn't Jeopardy, y'all. I mean, if somebody wants to have a note and a bullet point, make sure you say this, make sure you remember that. I don't understand the purpose of that either, Eric.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, the idea is that it's not necessarily a trivia question how strong is your memory for certain data points. It's good to have the facts in front of you, as you will have every single moment that you're president of the United States. You'll be able to have your facts with you, and they also are not allowed to ask questions of each other, which I don't quite understand why that rule's not in place. That's not how people actually argue or debate in real life. You know, you shouldn't say anything like, hey, John, how can you say that when you've said this? You know, things like that. That's how people argue. But my other observation here is I think Harris is going to have to walk a fine line between answering the misrepresentations that Donald Trump is going to offer. He's going to talk about, you know, 500,000 people are employed, or 50,000 people are employed in the fracking industry in Pennsylvania, or he'll talk about the idea that kids are going off to school and having operations turning them transgender.
Yes, and they come home.
All the goofy stuff he talks about. He's going to start, you know, the idea now that's going around, which is that illegal or these migrants from Venezuela are in Haiti are eating your pets. this is just like these are crazy things that are getting said on this campaign.
Yeah.
Just she's going to have to figure out some way to answer some of those, but not be on the defensive the whole time. Because if you're on the defensive,
right,
in a thing, you're losing. So
she's
going to have to parry those quickly, and she's going to have to turn to her talking points without feeling like she's avoiding them. And that's a tough job. I've only seen her debate once. I guess I saw some of the primary debates back in, what was it, 2019. But I saw her debate Mike Pence, and she was pretty good there. But that was a vice presidential debate. And And it wasn't all that.
Well, about their not allowing the candidates to ask questions of the other, then you lose control of the debate. If you want to maybe get an answer from one of the candidates about the economy, but in the previous answer, one of the candidates asked directly a question to the opponent, then that opponent now has to either decide, do I address the charge just leveled at me by the other person standing here, or do I actually take David Muir's question? And they may opt to ignore Muir and respond to each other. So I can see why you don't want them asking questions to each other, although it does sort of kill the spontaneity of the thing, the liveliness of the thing. But I think I would side with them on that. WGN Radio, John Williams here with my friend Eric Zorn. By the way, Eric, I meant to ask you this, and I see our listeners are doing the same. Please ask Eric to repeat the name of the poem and the author. I'm officiating a wedding in a couple of weeks, and I'd love to be able to find that. Eric, are you willing to share?
Yes, I totally am. It's Neil Gaiman, G-A-I-M-A-N, is the author, and the line to look for, the search for. I'm not exactly sure the title, but the first line is, "This is everything I have to tell you about love: colon nothing." So if you search, I just search for Neil Gaiman poem. Yeah. Nothing, and I found it. Neil Gaiman is a bit of a problematic figure, unfortunately. If you're into this character of the artist business, he's been accused of sexual assault by, I think, four or five women, and it was a little bit. I didn't realize that until this morning when I was looking at some other reader feedback. I went, "Oh man, I've got a guy who's problematic." But anyway, it is a gorgeous poem. It is. And it talks about love in a very realistic way. As you could tell, I kind of got choked up just reading those lines from it.
No, but I hadn't picked that up. Well, that sentiment in the universe is true, even if the person that brought it to mind was imperfect or criminal. All I'm saying is I thought I got goosebumps when you read the first line of that. Neil Gaiman, G-A-I-M-E-N. Producer Pete will get this.
M-A-N, G-A-I-M-A-N.
M-A-N. Good enough. And this is everything I have to tell you about love, nothing. Google that or search that, as the kids say, and you'll be able to find it. What do you make of the fact that Mayor Johnson says that we need a hiring freeze? We've got a huge budget gap and we're not going to hire anybody. Attrition is going to take a toll on the city. Honestly, Eric, I think all levels of government should do that. What's your reaction?
I agree with most levels of government. I see that he's also imposed the hiring freeze on the police and fire departments, and there's been a lot of pushback on that. We are understaffed on the police department, or the numbers are down. I don't know what understaffed means exactly when it comes to police departments, but we have something like 1,300 fewer officers now than we did before. And as John Catanzara, who's the head of the local fraternal order of police, is someone who I distance myself from in most cases. He points out that with attrition, now, officers retire all the time or they move to other departments. With attrition, that's going to keep getting lower and lower. And we do need to have a strong police force in this town, clearly. Yeah. And I think when I read we're going to be limiting travel and overtime expenses, I'm thinking a city that is in as much budget difficulties as Chicago should have already cracked down on travel and on bureaucratic overtime. They need to make their mission fit the money that we have, rather than say, "Oh, we've got to go to this conference of city administrators in Las Vegas and stuff like that." I mean, I'm not sure exactly what kind of travel they're talking about, but that's probably the sort of thing that we're looking at, that they do need to tighten their belts quite a bit. I have no idea from what I've read whether this is going to make any kind of significant dent in what's
$500 million. Yeah, right. It's funny because they should just ask Tiffany Henyard what she does and then do the opposite of that. Whatever they're doing in Dalton, don't do that, and then you will at least shore up some of your expenses. Talk to me briefly, Eric, about ShotSpotter. We visited with one of the older persons who was a great advocate of it, and I know there are critics. Where are you about this technology in the city?
I would agree with the critics of the mayor who are saying that this is a kind of technology, and for anyone who doesn't know what it is, it's gunfire detection technology that pinpoints about the approximate location of gunfire very quickly and alerts first responders. Mayor Johnson said getting rid of it is one of his priorities. It costs about $10 million a year. And on Monday, the alderman called on the mayor again to stop this phase out of ShotSpotter, which is supposed to start on the 22nd, Sunday the 22nd of this month. He's going to get into some sort of a vague 2-month phase out of this technology. The council voted 34-14 back in May to give the power of ShotSpotter's future back to the council. The city council wants it, and particularly the aldermen in the neighborhoods that are served, the high crime neighborhoods that are served by ShotSpotter, want it. And that's good enough for me. It's not in my neighborhood on the northwest side, but it's in these neighborhoods that are really afflicted by high crime. From Jake Sheridan's story in the Tribune this morning, he says Monday, ShotSpotter supporters touted new data collected by the police department showing that the system is 99.6% accurate in identifying gunshots, and police responded 2.5 minutes faster to gunshot reports when ShotSpotter alerts were made, and rendered aid to 143 gunshot victims, including people who were treated despite no corresponding 911 calls. And then what happens in some of these neighborhoods is gunfire is so common that people are so discouraged they don't call 911. So, again, I defer to the neighbors and the alder people who are representing these neighborhoods and not the mayor who made this a campaign promise. And now seems like he wants to keep it, and seems like he's being very stubborn about it. He bragged all about how collaborative and cooperative he was, but here he's just doing my way or the highway.
Chris Taliaferro in the 29th had a great line about this. He said, none of us want ShotSpotter in our wards, but we need it. So, yeah, that's about as simple and clear a position as I think you can get. I'm out of time. Eric, my best to you and your family. Again, the poem that you read was from a poet named Neil Gaiman, G-A-I-M-A-N. And the line that you began with was, this is everything I have to tell you about love. And I was touched by your reading it, even if the person that wrote it wasn't perfect. It's nice to talk to you. We'll do the Mincing Rascals podcast tomorrow, my friend.
I look forward to it, John. Thanks.